Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Hello and good morning. 4 minutes after the hour. Hope you had a good night's sleep. Hope you feel rested, ready to go. Very excited about today's show. We've got Dr. Heather Peterson coming up in just a minute. She's going to give us some advice on what words not to use if we want to sound smart. So I'm going to pay very careful attention. Actually, we had her in studio yesterday to record the segment, so we're going to air that this morning in about 5 minutes. And it's surprising how lazy we can get and how we keep returning to use the same phrases and expressions over and over. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. I want to start with a proverb. This is one I've chewed on for a long time, Proverbs 27:5. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. I need some help with that one. If you want to send me some help, I need it because I just think this is a strong verse. We need to, I think it was Tommy Lasorda, the one-time Los Angeles Dodgers manager, that said that whenever you're managing players, it was like holding a bird in your hand. You grip it too firmly and you'll crush it too loosely and it escapes and flies away. And I sometimes think that God has us in the grip of his hand and he has us so gently and he's so loving, and yet we can still kind of squirm out at times. In our opinion, we never leave his grip, but sometimes we wander off. And when somebody comes along with an open rebuke to someone in the family of God, it can save our lives. Versus, well, I don't want to say something to him because I just love him too much and I don't want to hurt him. It's a fine line. I need some counsel on this. Maybe if there's a pastor out there listening this morning, you can email me or even call, because I'd love to hear more about this. J. Vernon McGee has got a great line. He said, this is sent to me by Rebecca yesterday, "This is God's universe, and he does things his way. You may think you have a better way, but you don't have a universe." All right, 6 minutes after the hour, let's get the day started, and let's say things that make us sound smarter. Dr. Heather Peterson up next. Welcome back to the show. You know, we all use words every day, and sometimes we use words a lot that aren't necessary, or we use words that don't make us sound very smart, and we all want to sound smarter. So I thought, well, I know the way to solve that issue. I've invited into our studio Dr. Heather Peterson, Assistant Professor of English and Literature here at the University of Northwestern, and the chair. So we're going to talk about maybe some words we should eliminate from our vocabulary to sound smarter. It doesn't mean I'll be smarter. I just want to sound smarter. That's the goal. Hello, Heather.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. All right, let's talk. You know, I hear words all the time that start to bug me, and I think, huh, I wonder what I say that bug other people. And I'm sure the list is long.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start talking about some words that might not be a bad idea to get rid of from our vocabulary. The first word that comes to mind is the word that.
That?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, tell me about that, because I've never heard of getting rid of that from my vocabulary.
Okay, when we say that, don't use that when you refer to people. Like, I have several friends that live in the neighborhood.
Okay, all right, so now I know what you mean. So you mean who?
Yes,
instead.
Exactly.
You mean who? So I have several friends who live in the neighborhood. And actually many people do that. So you're right. And it's an issue actually in students' papers.
Yeah. Is that a sloppiness thing, or did we never learn it correctly in the first place?
That's interesting. You know, I think we probably never learned it correctly mm-hmm. in the first place. I think that so many people do it and so many parents do it. And even I was reading a book to my daughter yesterday, or actually she was reading to me. I read parts of it and she reads parts of it. And I'm pretty sure they used a that where they should have used a who.
Interesting.
Right? But it slows me down, so I have to look at it later. But yeah.
Uh-huh. All right. How about went? The word went. I went to school or the store or to church. Hmm. And should we maybe use more colorful words instead of went? I drove to the store. I skated to the store versus I went to the store.
Well, I think particularly if you're writing, okay. you want to use some more colorful words, right? In everyday speech, a lot of people aren't going to notice.
Okay.
But if you're writing, you want to have strong verbs that are vivid and that stand out. So I would agree with that.
Okay. How about the word honestly? Oh, boy, this is a pet peeve of mine.
People just overuse honestly, right? uh-huh. And they don't always mean it when they're talking about being honest. They just throw it in, I think, as a way to pause or slow down as they think, perhaps, mm-hmm. right?
Are they just trying to add emphasis, do you think?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and trying to make their whatever they're trying to say seem more real or authentic or whatever. But
right.
honestly is, I think it's something that we wear out.
Yeah, I agree. They're trying to make it sound important.
Yes.
Honestly. So listen now. Right. Like saying behold in the Bible, maybe.
The what?
Saying behold in the Bible.
Oh, right.
Does it sound better to you if we say verily?
Verily.
No, don't say that. That'll throw me for a loop.
Okay.
All right. How about the word absolutely?
Oh, that's overused too.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. It's redundant, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And saying absolutely doesn't make it any more necessary, does it?
Right. Or more true. Right. Right. So absolutely, I will do this. It's just saying yes.
Uh-huh.
Right. Where uh-huh. maybe if we just had a simple yes and then actually did it, that would be more important.
All right. How about the word very?
Very. Meaning that we overuse it?
We use it too often, right? We should be finding something to replace it with, shouldn't we?
Okay.
If you're very happy.
Hmm.
How about, I'm ecstatic.
I'm ecstatic, right. So just using a stronger adjective
yes.
or a stronger adverb. Actually, a concern I have, though, is a lot of people don't use very. They use really when they mean very. So I'm really tired.
Oh, interesting.
Right? But really should mean actually mm-hmm. in standard English.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be better if they said very instead of really.
Interesting. So is that another writing thing versus a speaking thing? If I said, I'm exhausted, isn't that more descriptive?
Yeah, that is more descriptive.
Yeah.
Right.
And isn't that more, isn't it a stronger message than I'm very tired?
Yeah.
Well, I'm
agree.
Very tired too.
Right.
You know, I'm exhausted. Why?
Right. And then you're using a word, right, that's descriptive, that stands out, that appears expressive, and it makes you sound articulate.
Yeah, that's yep. true. All right. okay, this one bugs me for sure, the word really. Now, we're kind of just talking about that, but let's get to it. This almost is from the Valley Girl lingo of 1985. So it's really, that gets used way too much in speaking and in writing.
Mm-hmm. So we could choose stronger words, or we could say intensely.
Mm-hmm.
There's other words that we could use instead.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on to amazing. It's amazing.
Right.
we're killing that one.
Okay, right, we're killing it. And again, amazing should be something that's truly amazing, right? It should be something that would rarely happen, but we use amazing to describe anything that we think is good mm-hmm. right now. So again, overused word, really, really just used to stand out. Right?
But when I hear it being overused, like anything, it starts to absolutely lose any of its punch. I guess more other synonyms we could use would be wonderful, incredible, marvelous, astonishing, astounding, remarkable, miraculous, surprising, mind-blowing, and staggering.
That was a lovely list of synonyms.
That's a pretty good list of synonyms.
Synonyms. That's right.
You know what I'm trying to say, don't you? Help me out here, word nerds.
Synonyms.
Yeah.
Synonyms, right. Of course. I know that.
And I like staggering, right? Because it gives you a picture.
It does. Why are we, why do we not use better words?
I don't think we're reading as well.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I think we are reading less. Mm-hmm. And when we are reading, we're reading on small screens.
Okay.
Right? And then we're reading maybe more popular things. So little articles, not as good literature where you have all those rich words.
But don't we have better access to dictionaries when we're reading online? Because we can just hold the cursor on the word if we want and boom, there's the definition versus having to walk across the room to the big dictionary and kind of start paging through looking for the word.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just used absolutely. I'm going to be very self-aware. Right? This is one of the things about being an English professor is I'm way too self-aware of what I'm saying. We do. We have wonderful dictionaries online. We can look things up. But I think that we're so about efficiency. We're so about speed now that we don't always do it. And there is. I mean, kids are taught that they should try to pick up on context as well. So it could be that we're trying to pick up on context. I mean, that would be a good thing. But also, I would even say our reading level has dropped, right? So it used to be that you were supposed to head towards an eighth grade level when you were writing. And now sometimes we wonder if it shouldn't be lower.
Interesting.
I hear that from publishers. So.
All right. I'm talking to Dr. Heather Peterson. She's in studio with me. We're going to take a little break. When we return, more and smarter ways to sound smart. This is why I brought her in, because I am the one that so desperately needs this. So this is a very selfish move on my part. But we'll continue our conversation in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have in studio Dr. Heather Peterson. She is assistant professor of English and literature here at the University of Northwestern and the chair. How cool is that? Okay, here's the one that I hear all the time, and it bugs me, drives me crazy. It's like.
Oh.
Help me with that, Heather.
Okay, so there are times we want to say it's like, because we're saying it's similar, right?
Yes.
It's like this. I think the issue is that we throw in the word like that we picked up, right? We picked up like from the Valley Girls, and it's been such a nice way to help us slow down our speech when we're processing that we all do it.
Okay.
And I do it. I catch myself saying like, right? As a way to kind of say, it's a way to add a little pause so I can process quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And it is hard to get rid of. It is really hard to get rid of.
Yeah. So when you talk about our reading has it's gotten maybe gone backwards a little bit, how do we gain by reading books in print versus on screen?
Personally, my husband actually has been in Christian publishing, so we talk about this a lot. I think reading books in print is a richer experience. I think it slows us down. It slows us down as far as that when we have a book open in front of us, we might think more about, I think I'm going to flip back.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to scroll back, we flip back, right? Remember, it was on the left-hand side of the page. I don't know if you've ever read a book and you're like, I know I saw this, and it was on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of the page. And we don't do that with screens as much.
No, we don't.
I also think that people in general like paper. They like to hold it. But, of course, this is me, right? I'm a proponent of paper because I'm a traditionalist, right?
Yeah.
And what's been found in the publishing world is that the books that actually do the best as far as e-versions are those super popular novels. They're not exactly literary novels that you want to read slowly and absorb. Those are ones that you want to read in like a few weeks, and then hopefully an author will pop out another one in 6 months.
So when I think of visualizing words and I see it on the left side of the page, that's certainly true of my Bible. I mean, because I've got lots of notes, handwritten notes, things underlined, and I go, I could actually picture where that verse is on what side of the page in my Bible.
Me too.
And yeah, so you too.
Right.
So you know the value of that. And for electronic books, one of the things that I find distracting is some of the things that you have in your lap. For example, you know, I might take a break from reading and just check a website real quick.
Yes.
Because that made me think of something else. And all of a sudden, I'm away from my book and I'm into something else and maybe I'm done.
Right. And it's really easy to do that. If you've got it on a screen, right, it's easy to get distracted. And that's something they've found with websites. If you have too many embedded links, right, you'll actually end up distracting the person from what they were reading instead.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to totally bash electronic books. And one of the reasons why is that if you want to look something up, for example, there's a word, right, you can find that word. I do love that about electronic books, even though I prefer paper most of the time.
Okay, let's say we wanted to sound smarter, and that would come from expanding our vocabulary, which is something I found I was interested in as a kid, mm-hmm. that I wanted to know what words meant.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was natural. And then what are some good ways to expand your vocabulary? Is it just good to read, or is it good to take one of those vocabulary-enhancing courses, or what do you recommend?
Well, definitely reading good books, but there are also websites, I'm not going to be able to come up with any right now, where you'll be sent a word a day.
Okay.
Right? And so the Merriam-Webster webpage, you can also go on and they'll give you a word a day too. Words that often we tend to make mistakes with or we might not know. And it's kind of a fun way to get introduced to a new word each day.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn from your parents when you were growing up in terms of the importance of reading words and expressing yourself well?
Oh, that is wonderful. That's a wonderful question. So I was surrounded by books.
Okay.
Right? And I saw my father constantly reading, which actually is really important because often men tend to read differently than women.
Mm-hmm.
Men tend to read things that are more functional, so they don't always read as much, and that's just male literacy. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, but they tend to read for functional reasons. Okay. Mm-hmm. And again, that's just a generalization. But my father read constantly. So there were books all around my house. And so I was constantly reading because he was always reading. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what we did. We read. And I would read books in trees. and then in my household, we would have these big discussions at the supper table where we would disagree about things. And now I look back and I'm a little worried about how my dad, and he knows like all my issues. So this is okay for me to say. Because he would actually like play the devil's advocate. And so we would discuss issues like theological issues, and he would play the devil's advocate, which I've decided I'm not going to do with my children because it was a little confusing uh-huh. at that age. But it really made me think, mm-hmm. and it made me question, and it made me learn and use new words mm-hmm. as I was growing up.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the ways in which we study the different languages of the Bible? Is that good for studying God's word to have different versions of scripture? I mean, are you a fan of like the Message and some of these paraphrases? For is that good for language? Is that good for God's word? Or is that like, ooh, we shouldn't be doing that at all?
Oh my, yes, we should be doing that.
Okay.
Yes. So I have talked and studied about this particular thing a lot. So we do want to look at a variety of translations. And my students and I, one of the things that we talk about in our class is it often depends on the situation. So if you know someone who's a new believer and they're not highly educated, maybe you would want to start with them on the Message, but then as they grow, give them a Bible that would be better for study, like the ESV, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think looking at a variety is good. I also feel like those translators, especially the NIV, the ESV, there's a new, I think it's called maybe the CSB, the Christian Standard Bible, which is similar to the ESV, which is a really wonderful translation. Those translators, they have really studied it in a way that even many of our pastors haven't.
Interesting.
Our pastors have studied it, you know, they've studied a language maybe for a year or two in seminary, but these translators have spent, you know, decades in it. And so we want to get their different interpretations, right? And we want to hear their voices and see, oh, well, here's something that people disagree a little bit about on, and actually that's a good thing. It's part of our faith is like, I'm just going to trust you, God, to guide me on this if there's a little bit of a difference.
Mm-hmm. All right. When we use big words in our conversation, what is the best thing to do when you hear a word you don't understand and you don't want to appear stupid? I have a friend that's got this little gag he plays where he's made up a word, and he'll sometimes when he'll use it in conversation, and no one ever stops to say, what is that word? I've never heard of
wow.
that before.
You know,
and they will respond as if they know what it is. And it's a made-up word. It's the word profensify.
Oh, my goodness. That is really fun. You know, I'm just about being authentic.
Okay.
And I'm just
tell.
I'm just about saying, actually, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
Would you tell me what that means?
But a lot of people, you know, they just don't want to appear stupid. So they'll respond like they kind of know what the word means. But I think it happens a lot in conversation.
I do. I think I'll, and occasionally, right, you can go a sentence or two, and occasionally I'll do that thinking maybe I'll figure it out,
right.
You know?
Right.
But eventually I ask. I mean, yesterday in class, I had an honor student say to me, what is rapport? And I thought, good for you that you asked.
An honor student.
Yes, an honor student. You know, a really smart young man asked me, what is rapport? I thought, hey, this is great, because what I usually find is that I'm not the only one, especially in a conversation with multiple people who don't understand, who doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm rarely, I used to always think it's just me, but it's so often other people too.
Yeah. Rebecca, I have to offer you maybe one question to Dr. Peterson with her here. And I know you've probably got something you might want to ask. I don't know that for a fact.
Well, how about the opposite end of the question that you just asked, Bill? If we are reading, if we want to expand and we want to use some of these cool new words that maybe feel a little bit more descriptive, a little bit more challenging, is there a way to start incorporating some of these words in our writing and in our speaking that just says, hey, I'm interested in, you know, communicating rather than I'm trying to prove something or I think I'm smarter than you?
What a lovely question.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Not driven from personal experience at all.
I think that is an excellent question. What I would say is you want to do it kind of sparsely, right? You want to choose carefully, and you don't want to do it a lot, because if you're using a lot of big words, you're going to come off like you think you're more intelligent than other people. And that's just a social perception, right? It doesn't have to be true, but it could come off that way. So you want to do it in a sparse way where you just choose one or two words and not a lot. And I've known, especially unfortunately, pastors who sometimes use really big words a lot, and they lose their congregation, right? But their congregation, because they look up to them, they might not question them on it or say something. Can I tell a little story?
Please.
My twin brother has this great story. He's a pastor in Wisconsin. But before he did that, he was in rural Iowa at a church that we attended as children. And, you know, those farmers' wives, they told him to knock it off. And, and that was really helpful for him. So he got better at using them sparsely and then defining them if he needed to, if they were theological terms.
Yeah. Well, Heather, this has been a profensifying experience having you in studio today. So thank you so much for coming in. I've been looking forward to having this conversation because I love words and I knew you would be outstanding, and you have been, so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I've had so much fun.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. Dr. Heather Peterson, Associate Professor of English and Literature here at University of Northwestern, and the chair has been my guest. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. All right, it's 1:30. Dr. Kent Kaiser just walked in, and he's got something to say about words. He's all bugged about the word feel. That's how I feel. No, don't tell me how you feel. Tell me what you think. That's what's up next. Take a break for news. Be back in a minute. Good morning. 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Gary Barkalow is an author and founder of the Noble Heart. He says, as Christians, we believe that God has a plan for our life. Sometimes it's hard to see what it is. He talks about this.
I think so many times when God asks us to make a change, or I like to call it a realignment of our life, after he's shown us more about who we are, what he's put in our heart, what we bring to the world, and he's been working on our strength of heart, our character, he asks us for realignments, and I think often God is saying it's something smaller than we're thinking. He's saying, I just want you to speak up now when you're at work. I want you to offer more often, or perhaps he's saying, you know, don't speak up all the time. Wait until you're invited, or whatever he asks, but I think it's common, and I actually think the enemy plays this out. He plays this all or nothing with us. Well, it's a leap of faith. You're going to have to quit your job. You're going to have to move. You're going to have to... And so we get fearful, and we usually go toward the side of doing nothing in our fear when I think God may be saying, no, I actually only asked you for a small change right now, and more will come, and it will be a big change in time.
That is some good content. I also like to pick people whose names that are fun to say. That was Gary Barkalow. If you want to hear that full interview, go to myfaithradio.com, type in Gary Barkalow. There we go. Take a short break and be back with Dr. Ken Kaiser.
When you advocate for social justice, make sure you know what you're talking about. This is Jim Garlow. There's a distinction between so-called social justice, which is basically, I want the government to take from you and give to me, and authentic biblical justice, where people are to be treated equally under the law, out of love for God, willingly, lovingly, and generously providing for their neighbor. The vast number of references in Scripture to loving the poor are not about the government taking wealth away from the rich, but are overwhelmingly about God compelling people to provide for others, voluntarily, cheerfully. Biblical justice is rooted in the transformational love of God, impacting the human heart to truly love one's neighbor, especially the poor, the widow, and the orphan. As the people of God, let's act like the people of God. Let's love our neighbor as we love ourselves. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
All right, your teeth might be vibrating. I get that. It's 23 minutes until the top of the hour. That music belongs to Kent Kaiser. He's in studio. And Kent, did you know on this day in 1962, Marvel Comic debuted The Incredible Hulk? So
interesting.
Dr. Kaiser, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
All right.
That's what I've got to say to you today. So you got a pet peeve about people, especially your students, that say, I feel.
Oh, yeah.
You don't like that,
every year it seems like I have to deliver this little sermon about why not to use the term I feel. For me, it's part of this sort of postmodernist cultural relativism. It used to be that people, when they were making an argument, would just say what they believed or what they thought and stand up for it. And then it sort of morphed over time into people saying that, well, it's just my opinion that,
right.
And then couched it in that. So that's sort of a hedge, and it becomes more difficult to have any kind of intellectual debate when you're debating opinions,
right,
and not facts or beliefs anymore. And then it morphed even farther from that to, oh, I feel this and I feel that. And well, at that point, I mean, how do you even begin to discuss or debate somebody's, that's beyond emotion. It becomes like, well, my feeling, you can't criticize my feeling because my feeling or my opinion is just as valid as anybody else's opinion, which of course we know is false. I mean, some people's opinions are dumb, but, you know, and wrong, you know, but, you know, as soon as you start saying, I feel, well, then you can throw out any old immoral idea, and it's very difficult to, attack it on an intellectual or fact-based basis. So, yeah.
Who wants to be told their thinking is wrong, though?
Well, and that's...
So if I say I feel, then aren't I more protected then?
Well, right, because then, if you go after that, it's really a belief, but if you go after that feeling or whatever, then you are attacking them on an emotional or sort of more sensory level and not on a cognitive level.
Mm-hmm.
I stop students in mid-sentence and they know it, and they kind of laugh in a way where they catch themselves. That's the other thing. They'll start, well, I feel blah, blah, blah. And wait, you think or you feel? And then, I think. And it's so funny how many times in class, after just a couple of weeks, they'll start catching themselves. They'll stop in mid-sentence. They'll say, I feel, I think. Or they'll catch one another. And so I don't even have to be the cop after a couple of weeks.
Yeah. I would imagine parents send their children off to college going, now go and feel.
Right. No, that's the thing. We're not, and actually I started this after it was a give credit to a professor that I had in graduate school. He was an older professor who was close to retirement, and he was actually team teaching with a very young professor who was younger than me. I was kind of older when I was in grad school, I was in my 40s, and the young professor liked to use that construction of I feel, or what do you feel? And that older professor corrected him mm-hmm. and said, well, I don't think we want to feel around here. This is in a psychology class, too. It was like, I don't think we want to be talking about our emotions here or mm-hmm. our feelings. We want to, we're intellectuals here. And he kind of took him to task in right. class, which I loved. And since then, I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna start doing that myself.
I like
and
that.
Correct the students because it's just poor construction, poor thinking. But there's more to it. Some people say it's just semantics, but I don't think it is just semantics. I think there's more to it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. All right. I found this story interesting. It still has a little bit of legs, in my opinion, because of its comedic value. Penn State says wilderness is too risky for the outdoors clubs.
Yeah, this is just bizarre. They've stopped having their outdoors clubs that would have, you know, things like camping and canoeing and kayaking and rock climbing because it's too dangerous. Now, mind you, they still have, I'm glad too, they still have a shooting club mm-hmm. and they still have football. I mean, because, you know, nobody ever gets hurt in football, right?
No, like, not
you
in
know,
football.
So it's kind of bizarre that they would get rid of this particular. You know, it's in this day and age, too, when we're encouraging people to go out and enjoy nature and enjoy, you know, God's
yeah,
beauty, wonder, and all this. And here we want to protect them from it somehow because they might get hurt.
But this is an outdoors club. That's the function of the club is to go outdoors.
Exactly. Now, I would love to know what their thinking is because it's not been articulated very well in any of these media reports. We just see the stupid decision that came at the end. But I kind of wonder if it's because it's so unorganized or it's so free-wielding and unorganized that they don't have, like, in football where you have a team doctor there or
right.
what it is that makes the outdoor club be the thing that they would want to pay. I'm sure that far fewer people get injured in an outdoor club at a university than in football or many of the other regular sports. And in fact, they've said in the media reports that nobody's been injured particularly, so...
Yeah, I don't get it.
I don't understand it.
But if you approach an organization like this, or any organization, Kent, and you say, tell me what you're thinking, does that sound like you're confronting them in a hostile way? Is that the world we live in today?
Well, if you ask them what they're thinking, yeah, that is hostile and should be. Because, they should be able to explain themselves why they would be banning what other people would think would be a very wholesome activity.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. All right, controversial right-winger Candace Owens. She's going to actually be in the Twin Cities in May. I think we're going to try to get her on the show, but she's got quite a bit of following now, and she's controversial. And
Well, she's controversial only because she's African-American,
right,
I think.
Exactly.
She's got views that many Americans espouse, and in fact, she's standing up for a lot of, you know, traditional American values and principles, and she's saying that the African-American community has been duped by the liberals, by Democrats particularly, and that they don't need these handouts and so on. And that is a controversial view on the liberal side
mm-hmm,
of politics in America today. And yes, she's going to be in the Twin Cities at a luncheon for Center of the American Experiment on May 8th. And so if anybody's interested in going to see her, they could go to the Center of the American Experiment's website and the event is there and they can sign up. It's relatively inexpensive to go and students can go for free, mm-hmm. by the way, because donors always pay for students to go. But she'll be here in the Twin Cities, but she's been very prominent in the media lately. And one exchange that's been pretty prominent lately has been her praise of Kanye West, or Kanye West's praise of her, and it's mm-hmm. It seems to be a mutual admiration club between the two of them, going back and forth, saying nice things about one another. Kanye said that he liked the way that Candace Owens thinks, mm-hmm. and he's doubled down. He hasn't backed off of that. And in fact, she's gone on to talk about good things that he said because they both seem to sort of cast off the idea that African Americans should automatically be liberal or automatically espouse liberal views or subscribe to Democratic policies. And I think that this has got to worry the Democrats a little bit because Kanye West is not known to be particularly political. I mean, he's not aligned with one party or another, and neither are most African Americans. Now, most have in the past couple of elections voted for the Democratic candidates. But I think if you went out and asked the, rank and file African-American voters, they wouldn't necessarily say that they were aligned with a particular party. So at this point, the Democrats have got to be a little bit worried when you've got people as prominent as Kanye West saying that they, you know, can get by without Democratic policies. And especially when you pile that on top of what's been happening for African Americans in a real tangible way with this economy, we have like the lowest rates of African American unemployment on record in the Trump administration. And so when, you know, if this next election cycle or even the next election cycle with for the presidency, African Americans might not be a guaranteed lock as a voting block for the Democratic Party. And that's got to make them nervous.
I bet. Kent, let me take a break. When we come back, more with Dr. Kent Kaiser, 13 minutes till the top of the hour. All right, we are back. It's 11 minutes till the top of the hour. In 1970, there were some predictions about Earth Day. Ken, what happened then?
Yeah.
What did they say and what's the reality?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, these alarmists. And I admire Earth Day. I think it's a good thing. Personally, I, for several years, got out and I have adopted part of the highway up north.
Really?
And my niece and I go out and clean the highway each year. And I mean, I think people obviously should take care of, you know, the natural beauty and so on. But some of these alarmist predictions from days gone by look pretty ridiculous today. Yeah, one prediction, there was a biologist from Harvard who estimated that civilization would end in 15 to 30 years unless immediate action was taken to face, to ameliorate the problems facing mankind. That was in like 1970. And Paul Ehrlich is pretty famous, a famous alarmist, suggested that people would be dying at the rates of 100 to 200 million per year for the next 10 years. He predicted that in 1970. Mm-hmm. In the highly respected Mademoiselle magazine, by the way. but he suggested that that would happen, starving to death at that rate for the next 10 years, and that our population growth would outstrip whatever small increases in food supplies we would make. Well, of course, we know today starvation is at among the, probably the lowest level it's ever been at. And I saw one statistic saying that you could actually house all of the people in the world. Like, I mean, it'd be amazing to think of this in 1/3 of the area of Texas. Now, of course, they'd be packed in there and we'd be living really in tight quarters, but that you could feed those people off of the other 2/3 of the land of Texas, just Texas. That's
wow.
The whole world.
That's amazing.
You know, with the technology that we have today. Now, obviously, that technology didn't exist in 1970, but these alarmists, you know, they could envision doom, but they couldn't somehow envision the advances that we actually had made in the technology to be able to feed people across the globe. So that's what's makes it kind of funny in a way today to read these comments that they made back then. But, you know, another Ehrlich also said later in 1970s that between 1980 and 89, 4 billion people, including 65 million Americans, would perish in what he called the Great Die-Off. Well, we didn't see that. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember the 1980s?
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't have massive people dying of starvation in the United States or, you know, even 4 billion across the globe. Think about that. That would have been like, oh my goodness, that would have been like half the population or more back then. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't happen. So some of these predictions are, they just lose all credibility when they make these kinds of predictions that, and not even just because they don't eventually come to pass, but they seem ridiculous at the time. And then you come to find out later on that, in fact, they were ridiculous.
Is being an alarmist a good paying job?
Well, it seems to be for some of these people. They write books. And, you know, they have, I suppose, academic appointments and things that, you know, pay them decently, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And they get called to speak to groups and they get called up to do interviews in the media. And, you know, I mean, the media are always looking for
sensationalists.
Yeah,
they
really are.
Yeah.
And so these are the immediate people you want to call up if you want to have a sensational show.
Yeah. All right, Kent, let's talk a little bit about the president, and he appears to have, according to this story, a fair amount of below the surface strength. Did you?
Yeah, this kind of goes back to what I was saying. What we're talking about with Kanye West. You know, It appears that there's a lot of support out there from sort of what you call undecided voters or people who are in the middle. Of course, you know, when there's a lot of polling, there's polling every single day mm-hmm. about the popularity of the president. And it's inched up a little bit here and there. Now, also, his negatives have inched up slightly since the election. But pretty much the polls are very similar to where they were right before the last election. What has changed is not the people who strongly love the president or the people who strongly despise the president. But in the middle, you have people who are pretty okay with him. And right now, the economy is going along pretty well, and so those people are pretty happy about that. The unemployment rate is very low. In fact, we had statistics yesterday. We have record low unemployment in something like 17 states across the country, many of them in the areas that Trump didn't actually win. And so he's making these little inroads with people who probably didn't vote for him before. And so he looks to be, when you do the analysis, he looks to be stronger now than he was right before the election. So the idea is that if the election were held today, now obviously it'd be a different election, he wouldn't be having that gift of Hillary Clinton to run against, the worst candidate who, you know, has run for president in recent memory. But he would be in pretty strong standing in his own stead, it seems, based on these polls and mm-hmm. based on where he is with those people who are kind of uncommitted politically.
Mm-hmm. All right, big state dinner. Was it last night or the night before?
Yeah, with the president of France.
Yeah. And I heard that President Trump brushed a speck of dandruff off Macron's jacket, which I think is kind of charming because I certainly wipe breakfast food off your shirt in the morning when you come in.
Hey, people can't see that.
But I mean,
they don't need to conjure up those images in their head when they're driving. Yeah.
I mean, you know, he was on a television show. You know, people get on the set and they go, let me take care of that.
Right.
I mean, that's just what you do.
Right.
It's kind of sweet, I think, actually.
Yeah. Well, it seems like they actually have really good rapport. And
yeah.
So anybody who's making anything of it, it seems like the Trumps and the Macrons are actually very friendly and getting along
yeah.
really well.
Kind of nice, isn't it?
It's kind of funny how, you know, and the big talk was the First Lady's wardrobe, you know. I mean, and she was stunning.
Right.
But it's some people got to criticize, but of course, you know, she was making a point of which designer she was
yeah.
wearing. She was wearing a French designer's hat and,
right.
and so on. So.
So if President Trump and Kim Jong-un get in the same room, is that the battle of the really bad haircuts?
I think so. I think I'd take Trump's haircut over.
I would too. I would too. He's the only guy in the country that has that haircut. Well, both of them, probably, for that matter.
Yeah.
But if you're Kim Jong-un's barber, you're probably not allowed to cut hair that looks like him.
Yeah.
Ever. Right?
Yeah.
All right. I don't know how I got on that subject.
It's kind of funny because, you know, if you look back in history, you know, Obama barely just talked about sort of demilitarizing and got a, you know, Nobel Peace Prize.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have Trump who might actually make some headway
right.
in terms of denuclearization. And nobody's talking about a Nobel Peace Prize for him.
Right.
Except me. I'm talking about it
You're
right now.
You're talking about it on the show. I appreciate you, Kent. Thanks for coming in. Always like talking to you on Wednesdays. Today's Wednesday, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, good. We'll take a break. Wrap up Hour 1 in just a minute. Thanks for listening this morning. Hour 2 is just ahead. Bill English is in studio. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.